And that's the kicking music that means it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week, we're going to talk a tiny bit about what we didn't get to last week. You'll hear more about that later. And then we're going to talk about a new movie that made a great deal of money this last weekend, Wreck-It Ralph. After that, we're going to be talking about children and parents in popular culture. And then, as always, we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's go around the table. Steve Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I'm a writer and editor covering movies, pop culture, theater, that sort of thing.
Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, I feel that I have to start off today by clarifying that this has not been my tip-top day. I had a minor apartment flood this morning.
If Linda seems unusually sullen in this episode.
Yeah, it's true. And that is not related to the fact that last week at this time we were not here, or most of us were not here. I know Trey and Stephen pulled out the intro. But most of us were not here because of the bad weather.
Yes, Superstorm Sandy.
And to all of you out there who may still be suffering with the after effects of that, we are thinking of you.
Absolutely.
Wishing you the best. Hope everybody gets power and back at home. But here's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because we didn't do a show last week, it was almost like Stephen and I saw Cloud Atlas at 9:50 at night for nothing.
Wow. You went at 9:50 to a three-hour movie?
It was 9:50. And I don't mean to be all, like, the real victims of the storm.
Oh, man.
I mean, no, we're not.
Because we're not. And we were even lucky enough in that screening to not see the 7-minute Les Miserables preview.
There you're obsessed with
wow.
this. You're obsessed with this. But we did see Cloud Atlas.
Yes, we
and,
did.
And Trey had seen it in Toronto, and Glenn actually went out and saw Cloud Atlas. So we all saw Cloud Atlas. So we feel like we at least have to get basic thoughts on the table.
I think it's on cable by now. I think it's already out of theaters.
I think it is. I want to start with Glenn. Glenn, Cloud Atlas, and you.
So first thing, I've read the book. Have you guys read the book?
I have not.
Okay.
Nope.
The least interesting, stupidest, most shallow kind of criticism to do about any book that's been made into a movie is to say the book is better.
Right.
That said, seriously, guys, oh my God, the book is so much better.
Yeah.
Because the book is a stylistic masterpiece because, of course, each of those different stories that you see in this movie are written in a vastly different tone and mood and style. And it borders on pastiche and sometimes shades over into parody. So the first chapter of this movie, which is about a guy on a ship, is a parody of Melville. And the composer section is pure Isherwood. And my favorite section of the book, at least, is this section about the nuclear power plant, which is pure Clive Cussler, John Grisham, really parodies, terrible, terrible writing, like, you know, no, he ejaculated, and what, she inquired, like all that kind of really basic bad writing.
Sure.
But you don't get any of that in this film because it is all so equally flatly asserted. So what the movie pulled out was the plot, and the plot is not why you're reading
Cloud Atlas. But I have to tell you, though, that where I would disagree with you a little bit, and I can't speak to the difference between the movie and the book, but I absolutely said after I saw the movie, it's like it's a set of genre movies. So the point about them being in the style of other things and it feeling like six different stories because they're in six different styles, to me it was like the nuclear power plant stuff is like a 70s paranoid thriller.
Right.
I had the same reaction to the sort of that the ship is kind of one sort of historical drama. The composer is another kind of historical drama.
Mm-hmm. You have a Daffy comedy.
The neo-soul is a sci-fi picture, and the one where everyone is Jar Jar Binks.
On a true.
Yeah.
I do think that's more a matter of form, though, than of style and tone. And I think probably necessarily so. I think it would be very jarring to have a movie that was as variegated as what Glenn is describing.
But I did get the feel that it was, I mean, I got the sense of that same thing that they were genre pieces in the way that Glenn's talking about. And I don't come down on this movie saying this is a bunch of just baloney, which a lot of people have sort of said. It's a bunch of overblown baloney. I get what they're doing. And I respect what they're doing in a sense. They're trying to get after these big themes about love and sacrifice and evil across time. And
well, one thing that I said to you in the immediate aftermath of seeing this movie was that movie is both incredibly complex and incredibly simplistic.
Yeah,
right.
And that it really boils down entirely, I'm not giving anything away when I say that the movie boils down to, here are a bunch of things that happened. They're all connected.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that's literally the only point to this movie.
This notion of connectedness as the organizing principle, this fortune cookie metaphysics that this movie has, that the Wachowskis are taking very seriously and the book plays with. The structure of the book is what the book's about, in a way, because it starts and tells the first story, gets halfway through, then starts the second story, then starts the third story halfway through, and then it closes up. It reads 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, tells the entire sixth story, and then gives you the back end of 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
So they're nested.
So they're nested.
Like Russian nesting doll story.
Exactly. So you pick up this through line very subtly. These associations kind of occur at oblique angles, and you are much more engaged. You're with the work. Obviously, they can't do that with a movie, so they do this ham-handed montage and somebody saying he's a bad person.
And they
cut
it through
to a bad
casting.
Person. Yeah.
And they do it through the casting. Mm-hmm.
I will say, though, it's a nearly 3-hour film. I was not bored. That's what would make this film unbearable. Well, it's a fiasco, but it's a glorious one.
Well, and as simplistic as it ultimately is, it's also kind of an idea salad.
Yeah.
So much is being thrown at the screen at any given time. And even just playing the sort of games of which actor is playing this role, you know, through the just heaping globs of nose putty.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I found completely and utterly distracting
in
every minute of this movie.
And that's what Trey and Bob said after they saw it in Toronto.
And it's interesting because a movie like this is so constructed to be an effects movie and so much like, well, if you're going to do through the ages and all these different people and their different races and their different blah, 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 that it should just be an absolute triumph of makeup. Now, part of it is that these are very, very familiar actors' faces.
Right, exactly.
But the makeup in many chunks of this movie is horrible.
At least it's distracting.
And I'm not sure it's a battle that the makeup person could have won. Mm-hmm. You know, make Hugh Grant an old man.
Well, I gotta say, boy, in terms of casting, Hugo Weaving as evil across time,
sure.
I get.
Yeah,
right.
Hugh Grant as a lesser, more cheap kind of evil across time. I don't know.
Yeah.
And boy, the Hugh Grant old man makeup was, those of you who saw Prometheus, it was Guy Pearce in Prometheus over again.
It literally looked like he was wearing like a rubber Richard Nixon mask. Halloween masks.
Yeah,
well, also
did.
Getting back to the casting, I mean, Tom Hanks is never not Tom Hanks, no matter what he is. So even if you slap him in a macrame shawl that Janis Joplin would look at and go, well, I don't know. Or you got Halle Berry where you can charge an iPhone on her face. She's still Halle Berry. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So the selection of these actors just kind of worked at cross purposes to the purpose.
I think that's absolutely true.
But the purpose is we're all connected.
Right. But we are all connected. And we did feel like we sort of had to cover a little bit of territory regarding Cloud Atlas.
I just got 2 hours and 50 minutes of my life back.
Because Stephen and I did go see it quite late at night. And he was very pleased to point out, by the way, that they did not show the 7 minute.
Thank goodness.
Exactly.
But they did show it before Wreck-It Ralph.
They did.
Because
show
if there's one thing
Wreck-It
a bunch Ralph. Of 4 year olds want to see, it's
epic trailer
it's
for
Hugh Jackman doing the, what have I done?
Oh my gosh.
Jesus, what have I done?
This is now Steven's favorite thing is imitating. It was when we were at Cloud Atlas. He was standing behind me in the popcorn line in my ear going, they're doing it right now in there. I bet, what have I done? Sweet Jesus, what have I done? It's very disconcerting. Thompson doesn't sing to me a whole lot. But anyway, so we did see Wreck-It Ralph yesterday. Who saw Wreck-It Ralph? Did y'all?
I saw Wreck-It Ralph.
Oh, wonderful. Excellent. Trey Graham, what did you think of Wreck-It Ralph?
I have very little to say about this movie because I am here as the non-game nerd, and I guarantee you that most of the in-jokes went right over my head.
Mm-hmm.
But I am glad to say that it was perfectly entertaining anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed it quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think you're an important constituency for this movie because there certainly are people who will see it who did not completely geek out over every
Qbert appearance.
Qbert
the way Stephen did.
The way I did.
Yeah. I thought that was Tony Scott had a nice observation in his Times review. And the quote is, a genuine enthusiasm for the creative potential of games, a willingness to take them seriously without descending into nerdy pomposity, which triggered a memory in my head of a conversation that Roger Ebert has been having sort of fitfully about online.
About whether
a game can be art.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I definitely had some of those same thoughts. Glenn, how about you?
I was fine. I just didn't jive with this. I mean, I got the references, But mostly I wanted to see these actors I really like, John C. Reilly and Sarah Silverman. You know, anytime they got a little time together to do some business, some back and forth, mm-hmm. I was like, oh, these are, I love this. And then as soon as the machinations of this plot kicked in and they were forced to say things like, well, I got to win the race. Like, how many premises can one movie have? How many? I am all about.
I had a bit of an issue with that, too.
I am all about world building. I'm all about telling me the rules and I will be in. You know, I can tell Noldor elf from a Sindar elf. I'm the guy who you go to for, like, show me a big world. But first, the fact that the games come to life, that's fine. I get that. Then they can cross over to other games. Okay. Through a surge protector, sure. Then there's this virus thing. Okay. And then there's this virus. If it eats you, you become part of it. Fine. Unless there's a beacon. And then there's a glitch versus going turbo. Then you go into this candy game, which they spend, pet peeve of me, they spend about 70% of the movie in this candy, making candy puns.
Pink world. Yeah.
I was definitely ready for it to go back to
which had, the candy game had its own.
But that's, you know.
Yeah, the candy game had its own set of rules about, well, we have to win the race. It's like, pick a lane. Yeah. Tell me a story. not seven.
Well, and then you get the politics thing, right?
Yeah, sure. Right. Sure.
I liked the movie a lot, purely for the characterizations, which I thought were really charming. I think the characterization of Ralph, a.k.a. Donkey Kong, is very charming. And I like that idea of sort of being the person whose job it is to be the bad guy. And I got that. And I am not always a Sarah Silverman person. I tend to be sort of 50-50 with Sarah Silverman. But I really liked what she was doing, not just with the character who I thought was really adorably written. And I have to say, if Steven's daughter is any indication, there are a lot of little girls out there who, boy, it's a good thing they put this out right after Halloween.
Oh, right.
Or you would have been seeing a lot of little Vanellope's. Mm-hmm. But I really liked what she was doing with sort of the very childlike but yet funny, sharp voice. I really enjoyed that. And I liked, boy, I don't know that I've ever thought Jack McBrayer had a lot of range beyond Kenneth the Page, but this worked for me with him.
Right.
So there's a lot here that I liked in terms of the characters. Now, I spoke on Twitter last night about the fact that my one beef, I was sitting there so loving this characterization of Vanellope, who is kind of this racer girl, and there's this glitch business, which you sort of have to see, which makes a lot of sense, and which I have some theories about what kind of person would write that story and write that girl like that. But I would be speculating about writers' personal lives, which I wouldn't do. But at the end, and without, it's hard to explain this without getting into massive spoiler territory, but there's a kind of a triple deke at the end where they're trying to sort of say something about princesses and Disney princesses and visions of girls. And it's coming from a very good place. It's coming from a very positive, helpful, girls don't have to be the same way. But to me, it did not work. To me, I didn't want that piece in there at all. And I felt let down by kind of, there's a resolution to her story that to me is A, too abrupt, and B, takes you into this whole swamp in a way that they're trying to subvert it, but I would rather have just had it left out. And I was let down by that, I have to admit.
I mean, it kind of went past me as sort of, whatever. I kind of viewed it almost as a throw-in. Mm-hmm. But this movie, in many ways, was really, really made for me.
Yeah.
And I have gotten tweets about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, Scott Tobias at the AV Club predicted that my reaction would be the equivalent of watching the Beatles play the Ed Sullivan Show.
Yes.
I didn't have quite that reaction to it. I mean, if anything, it was so down the middle of my interests, vintage video games. I watch a lot of animated movies. Mm-hmm. I have young children. I probably had set my expectations so high that they were bound to be a little bit chopped down by some of the sort of conventions of the quest. I also am not as interested in the kind of Mario Kart world where they spent probably half the movie, though I thought it was gorgeously rendered. And I thought that, like every game that they address in that movie, I think they did sort of a spectacular job of sort of understanding those worlds and really rendering them with visual wit. I think the Fix-It Felix game, speaking as the owner of Donkey Kong, I thought was incredibly witty in the way that they sort of set up that particular world. I was certainly more interested in that world than I was in the Sugar Rush world.
Sure,
well, right, and then you get into the whole, like, mythology, the backstory of Sugar Rush, which I was like, I don't care about this. I like them. I like their story. There is a moment in this which has to do with her racing and his wrecking, mm-hmm. I'll say,
yeah.
that I thought was devastating, that mm-hmm. I thought was really a very effective emotional beat for mm-hmm. those two characters and for him particularly, that was believable conflict and stuff and really quite touching. So I cared about that, but the whole backstory of Sugar Rush to me was like, I don't
Well,
care.
I think in a lot of ways, the fault that I find in this movie is somewhat the fault that I find in a lot of superhero movies, which Glenn sort of touched on in the beginning here, where he's sort of saying, this is the origin story. Mm-hmm. This is setting up the intricacies of this universe and sort of what the rules are and how they work and how you get from place to place and what this world is like and what this world is like. Mm-hmm. After seeing it, I wanted to jump to the sequel.
Right.
And sure. I really, really, really liked this movie. And I got to say, as Linda mentioned, my 8-year-old daughter just flipped wig for this movie.
They put the lights up. We're walking out of the theater. And I hear her say, Dad, I really think we should get that on DVD. And I was talking to Steven's daughter after we had seen the movie. And I said, is this movie your favorite? Which is, of course, a kind of loaded and also leading question.
And she's just seen and gushed over Hotel Transylvania.
But she said yes.
Yeah.
Can you okay, speak? So related question, actually. Mm-hmm. As the father of a young girl and as the best friend of the father of a young girl, in a movie that has a female heroine, uh-huh. a female hero, is there anything problematic about the Lara Croft-style character played by Jane Lynch?
Oh, interesting. I didn't think about that.
I just felt like...
I mean, if you're going to depict a warrior woman in these worlds, mm-hmm. so many of these games are presumably programmed by men, mm-hmm. and the women always get rendered like that character, mm-hmm. right? Instead of what an actual Marine commando would
question.
Look like.
It's a fair question.
I guess I kind of blew somewhat by that. I mean, I didn't necessarily feel like she was rendered in a particularly cheesy way. I found that character just a little one-note, which is, you know, yeah. somewhat by design, as I sort of felt like I got a little more of that character and that character's backstory and that character's romantic interests yeah. than I particularly needed. I sort of blew past that character in part because I have never cottoned to those games. Mm-hmm. I have never been into the kind of hyper, quote-unquote, realistic, you know,
right.
war blast things. My knowledge and interest in video games really cuts off at the very latest, like 1989. I mean, I would say Smash TV yeah. was like the last new game yeah. that I've ever really reacted to. So anytime the movie kind of pushed into that Street Fighter place, mm-hmm. into the Hero's Duty, you know, which
right.
is the
sure.
one they make up, I was just a little bit less engaged by it. But, you know, the perfect target audience for this movie is an 8-year-old girl who is surrounded by vintage video games.
Yeah. True.
Because
true.
She was reacting, I've got Tapper, mm-hmm. you know, I've got Donkey Kong, I've got a whole bunch of these games. Okay. So she was getting all those references.
Yes. I don't think, Stephen, you're reacting to, I mean, the fact that you don't like a certain style of game, that's not necessarily what I found was going wrong here. I think you're reacting to the fact that this was just overloaded narratively, mm-hmm. that there are too many things going on, there's too many stories to keep track of, and I think what happens is the way you create a mythology, create a world, is you assert the rules, you don't insist upon them. Because every time you come back to say, oh, by the way, there's also this, you're asking us to make that balance, or to strike that balance yet again.
Well, and you're also telegraphing what's going to happen in the movie.
Exactly.
And I did notice that. There's a part where they're kind of going through the train station where you switch from one game to another, and you just basically get a graphic of who is it, Sonic, mm-hmm. who essentially says the thing about
right.
if you die in your own game, you don't regenerate, and it just is announced.
Right.
And so,
well, they announce that three different ways.
And I feel like what's going to come off here is that I didn't like it, which is not true. I liked it a lot. I just felt I share Glenn's sense that there was probably a little too much going on, and I had a little bit of an issue with the resolution of Vanellope. But I also think there's a tremendous amount, and there's a sequence where they're working on building her car, which mm-hmm. I think is tremendously great fun,
yeah.
and which I really liked, and I thought it was, I think it's visually interesting. Parts of the candy world, I think, are a little cliched, but parts of it, I think, are really cool and really fun, and I kind of got into the... I get into the Oreo joke, I'll say,
yeah.
Which I thought was very clever and a great example of something that's only funny to people who have certain references.
I do think it's also an incredibly sweet-natured film that was
yeah.
clearly made with an enormous amount of love for the world that it's like a very warm-hearted tribute to what it loves. I mean, I felt the most bittersweet thing about it was that it's ultimately set in this arcade, and there aren't arcades anymore outside outside of my house.
That's true. That's true. And I have to admit, I had sort of this thought of like, okay, so is the idea of this movie, now this is what Glenn would call vivisecting the unicorn, as you said, but I did have this thought of being like, so does this mean like each arcade would have this whole world of like each arcade has its own Wreck-It Ralph and its own whatever, but I'm vivisecting.
It's like, it's like A Bug's Life. It's just said, it's not all Ant Hood. It's just this one little pocket.
And I do want to talk about one other thing quickly, which is the short that shows before this movie, which I thought was enchanting. And something that was very interesting to me about, I was sitting next to Steven's daughter at this short. And the minute he started, it's essentially the story is about a man who meets a woman. It's dialogue free, sees a woman, and then is trying to sort of find her again. And is at one point throwing paper airplanes at the window of the office where she works. And when he began to throw these paper airplanes, and particularly when one of them went in the wrong window, she, Stephen's daughter, sat up in her seat. She had been sort of curled over with Dad and sort of sat up in her seat. And I saw her go, oh, and she was completely engaged with this thing, and it made me think, boy, black and white, guy, girl, no dialogue, what people think about the only things that you can get a current 8-year-old to care about are false. She loves, right now she loves Futurama.
Which, by the way, one of the writers on Futurama is Rich Moore, who co-wrote and directed this movie.
She loves Futurama. She loves a lot of sort of, you know, big, loud whatever. She was 100% honed in on this story of this man throwing paper airplanes to get this woman's attention. And I thought it was fascinating.
And I have to say, I mean, this is maybe this is an embarrassing admission. I kept, without thinking about it, I kept weeping. Like, I seriously kept having to having to dab my eyes. And it wasn't like, oh, this is so incredibly moving. There was just something, I think enchanting is the right word. Yeah. There's something very emotional about this very sweet, silly little light trifle.
I just loved it. I don't know. Maybe I'm weird in that way.
No, it was entirely charming, which, you know, is a word we keep coming back to.
Yeah. I enjoyed Wreck-It Ralph. I had a couple of complaints, but I personally would recommend it, especially for kids. I think many kids will find it absolutely huge fun. And I have many friends who have just absolutely loved and adored it. And I think, like Stephen, I think my expectations had really been raised by the people who I know who have been talking about it.
Right.
And I think maybe I was a little too in the market for something that was like mind-blowing, but I thought it was a good movie.
Yeah, I still quite liked it. And like I said, I mean, I will be first in line for the sequel because I can't wait to see how they sort of expand that world.
Well, having talked about a movie for kids, we're going to go ahead and talk about kids. We had a listener suggestion bouncing off of a TED Talk that was given by a playwright and poet named Lem Cissé, who talked about the fascination in fiction and in film. He's sort of talking about fostered children or children who in some way are separated from their original biological parents. And that can include kids for whom the care that they receive is relatively wonderful and lovely, like he mentions Luke Skywalker, or people where it is not, like he mentions Lisbeth Salander.
Sure,
and it's interesting because I think everybody thinks they know this. Everybody sort of thinks like, oh, yeah, because Disney films, there's never the mom is never alive and all that stuff. But it's not until somebody starts listing them all off and you say, well, yeah, if you count, you know, foster parents, adoptive parents, relatives other than your biological parents.
Urchins and orphans.
You start to get many of your major superheroes, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
Superman, Spider-Man.
Batman. Classically.
It really does. And then, like I said, Lisbeth Salander. And Harry Potter, and he starts to kind of expand this Pip.
Yeah.
And
it goes all the way back to Oedipus and Romulus and Remus. I mean, the abiding narrative of from orphanhood to greatness, which is sometimes followed by a tremendous fall, is a really old narrative.
Right. And we should also mention that in the talk, he essentially uses this as a jumping off point to talk about his own history as a child who was in the UK, essentially foster system. His birth mother had come from Ethiopia and eventually was sort of, in his version of the story, pushed essentially to place him for adoption. And, you know, a bunch of sort of unhappy circumstances followed. And so I would definitely encourage you to go and look at that talk. But I think for us, what we were sort of thinking about was what sort of the function is of this fascination with kind of beyond the sad story of every Disney movie having the scene where the parent dies. But if you include a broader range of things, what is the function of that sort of separation in narratives?
Well, mythically, I think what we're dealing with here is this notion of you create a hero that you want the reader to vibe with, as it were. And we've all experienced, even if we've grown up in very pampered, suburban, loving parents' lives, a feeling of isolation, which gives way to this fantasy of specialness. My parents are not my parents. I am a special smarty pants, and someday somebody's going to come along and rescue me from, you know...
And I'm going to discover that I came from a planet across the universe that's been destroyed.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Also, in the UK, it's a way to get your hero outside of the class system. Immediately remove him from the class system, so there's no upper barriers or lower barriers for him to fall under or above. Yeah. And in the U.S., it's really a metaphor for the American dream. It's really the Horatio Alger story of up by my bootstraps, I'm a Gatsby, I can recreate my life, I can burn the past.
Starting from nothing.
And it's something that it resonates with people. And in music, of course, I'm going to date myself, I'm 112 years old, but even in a song like Salisbury Hill by Peter Gabriel, what is that song about? An eagle coming, flying out of the night, and telling you, I've come to take you home.
Had to listen, had no choice. I did not believe the information. Just had to trust imagination. My heart going boom, boom, boom. Son, he said, grab your things, I've come to take you home.
That has a certain powerful emotional tug, even if you're perfectly happy.
I mean, I think orphanhood is sort of a creative shorthand for a lot of things. Glenn, you sort of said, well, it's shorthand for being misunderstood. It's also a shorthand for loneliness, and that it's very hard to convey loneliness in film, on the page, in music, and whatever. And so if you start out where the person, you know, is literally orphaned, it's a shortcut to a lot of things. And, you know, it can be sort of a metaphor for sort of growing up itself, where as you get older, you are more and more isolated from the comforts of childhood. And I think any time that you can sort of thrust a child into that situation in a piece of fiction, it's very powerful. It gets you there more quickly.
One of the things I was thinking about, too, one of my sort of hobby horses about fiction and also real life is that sometimes I think people are very hesitant to recognize independent personhood of children and young people. And this is less relevant to sort of older juveniles or whatever you'd say, like Luke Skywalker, but very relevant to people like Harry Potter. That when you remove people from that initial, what people assume is that initial bond, you sort of recognize that they have to create some sort of independent self. And I think very often, especially with kids under, say, 16, I think people have a great tendency to think of them primarily as sort of, they're kind of the outpost of their parents. And I think when you take a 10-year-old or a 12-year-old and you sort of say, okay, they are not part of that original unit anymore.
That negotiation doesn't exist.
It's easier to sort of give them some primacy in your story and make them sort of, this is really about them and their feelings and their emotional life. And it made me think of a movie I've talked about a few times that I saw at the film festival in Toronto, which is called What Maisie Knew, which is very, very loosely based on a Henry James novel. And what I said about it at the time is it's one of the few films I've seen in a really long time that is legitimately about the emotional life of a small child. You know, not as a comment on her parents, not as somebody else's story of which she is part. And she's only maybe 6 years old. And it is legitimately about her emotional life and her personal self and her personhood and her feelings. And I think that's another story where part of the way that emerges is that she has this separation from the care of her parents. So for me, it has something to do with recognizing and kind of enabling the autonomy, the emotional, personal autonomy of kids in stories by separating them from that.
I want to throw out a question about that's linked by, again, Oedipus and then Harry Potter. You have two figures who about whom a prophecy is made at the beginning. Oedipus goes to great lengths to nullify the prophecy. Harry Potter isn't sure about his prophecy and his, you know, his role in the functioning of that universe.
Sure.
I'm wondering if those two ideas suggest any kind of connection about determinacy or agency or anything like that.
I think what you're getting at is sort of similar to what I'm talking about,
yeah.
which is I think it is much easier to suggest that a kid is driving his own destiny and driving his own future, which again is related to what Glenn was talking about with the American dream. Mm-hmm. It's much easier to convey that a kid is really driving his own, you know, the kid is the captain of the ship, which has to do with fate and determinacy, as you're saying.
I'm sorry, let me follow up on that, because the Greeks certainly would not have understood that story that way. They would have argued that Oedipus was never in charge.
Of course.
We would understand the Harry Potter story rather differently.
So I guess what I'm saying is no, I don't think that those are the same story, because I think they would have been understood completely differently by the audiences for which they were intended.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, in a lot of these stories, it really, getting rid of the parents is just sort of a shortcut to reaching that destiny. Mm-hmm. And that a lot of stories where a non-orphan child is doing things, the parents are just there to be obstacles. Mm-hmm. And I sort of feel like it's one reason you see so many one-parent households in, like, Disney movies and whatever, is it's a lot easier to convey one parent doesn't understand than it is to convey that both your parents don't understand.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so in those movies, you have a lot of kind of dancing around and doing things behind a parent's back. And so orphaning a child, you know, creatively, it's a shortcut.
But I would say that there is definitely a through line here, and it's not my through line, it's Joseph Campbell's through line, the hero's journey, where when there is a call to adventure or somebody being told a prophecy or your destiny, there is a rejection of the call. That's part of the deal.
Right.
You turn it down. You say, this is not me.
Yeah. Again, Luke Skywalker.
Take this cup from my lips.
Buffy Summers.
Exactly.
Wow, good point.
But through this, the basic thing that comes through all these stories is this enormously comforting idea that where you are right now is not who you are, that you create who you are.
It's very thought-provoking, Glenn Weldon. I'm pausing to think about it.
Yeah, please do.
No, I really am. No, I think we're sort of all talking about the same thing, which is that a narrative is ultimately about a path. And I think kids in real life who have parents have limited control over their path. Mm-hmm. And in order to be a compelling protagonist, you have to have a fair amount of, as Trey would have said it, agency. Mm-hmm. You have to have a fair amount of control over, you say yes, you say no, you decide to pursue this, you decide to pursue that. Because if you're Harry Potter and there's a prophecy and your parents are there and they know about it, then they're going to decide whether you pursue it or not.
Right, yeah. Because a hero has to leave home, and whether or not they leave home because they're going on a quest, and their mom and dad are coming along, which would suck. I would not read that story.
Or maybe they left home because their apartment flooded.
Or maybe they left home because their apartment flooded.
And then they wind up on my couch.
That's right.
Heroes.
You're my hero, Linda Holmes.
Yeah, with my little medallion. So I would encourage all of you to go and listen to the TED Talk. We'll provide a link to that because it really is very interesting, both in general for his story and for his thoughts about all of this and for sort of what it may spark in you. Like I said, I think everyone thinks that they know that this is a common trope. And then he starts to list them and all of the different kinds of stories in which this appears. And I started to think, wow, yeah, it's actually more than I thought. Yeah. It's actually more than I thought. So thanks for that. Again, a listener suggestion. Feel free to share your listener suggestions or comment on this one at our Facebook page, which is at facebook.com/PCHH, or at the blog at npr.org/PCHH. That brings us to our final segment of the week. What is making us happy this week? Glenn Weldon, let's start with you. What's making you happy this week?
Assassin's Creed 3 came
out
this week.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow.
You play a dude in colonial Boston, and you kill folk, and you jump around rooftops, and it's great. Mine is not, however, an unalloyed joy, because friends came over on Saturday. They were at Best Buy. They said, hey, you want us to pick up this game? I said, sure. That's very nice of you. And then they came over, and we were hanging out, and they said, so play the game. And I'm like, well, it's it's a one-person game. I'm not going to play the game. And they're like, no. One of them was from Boston, and they studied that period. And they're like, no, I want to see how accurate it is.
How historically accurate it is.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, I mean, that's the big selling point of the game, is that they did a lot of work.
They did a lot of research, including the Native American characters.
But I'm assuming that the weaponry is probably more advanced. You're not reloading a musket every time.
So I remembered at that point, I was really reluctant to do this, but then I remembered a friend of mine who says that he and his wife, he plays a game like Skyrim. She sits on the couch and reads a book. Every so often she looks up and she says, oh, you go back to that room and you missed that thing. Or, oh, and they discuss strategy. You know, she kind of goes in and out. And I thought, that sounds idyllic. It sucks. Let me tell you, I start playing and I like to, this is an open world game. You can explore and go wherever you want. And so I start exploring and I'm like, but the general just told you to go over and meet this guy. I'm like, yes, he told me to do that, but I don't have to do that right now. I can just explore. Let me show you everything as it is. And they're like, well, we really kind of said it again. It's like, okay, fine.
So you were in the room with prescriptive game players.
So here's the thing that started happening. I get to this one level. I start playing the mission, and for whatever reason, I can't shoot the musket because I keep pressing the button to shoot the musket, but the game is not letting me shoot. So we're combining two things that are my favorite thing. One is having a computer not do the thing it is expressly made to do.
Yeah, Steven's with you.
Yeah, that's my least favorite thing of all the things.
And people telling me to do a thing that I'm already doing.
And you love that too.
Oh my God, so blinding white hot rage that I had to, because these are my friends and I love them, so all that had to go in directed inward into my stomach lining because I couldn't let it out. And because the game is so new, when I go online, there's nothing but videos. People want to show me the video. That's like, I just write it down for me. Tell me what I need to do that I'm not doing. But it's too new. I couldn't do it. Anger, white hot rage. Then today, this is what's truly making me happy. Turns out it's a glitch and that I didn't have my HUD enabled. Which happens to all guys, pretty much, I hear. And that if I were just to enable my HUD...
Happens to everybody.
Yes. I would solve this glitch. So thanks, orcs.com, O-R-C-Z, orcs.com, which is a little... They give you a little guide of what you have to do. So if it wasn't for orcs.com, I would still be shaking.
HUDless.
HUDless.
I have the same reaction every time...
the HUDless horseman.
Yes.
Oh, good.
Oh, boy.
I have the same reaction every time the cats watch me play Donkey Kong.
Well, thank you, Glenn Weldon. I enjoyed that story very much. Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week?
A streaming website called acorntv.com.
Yes.
Acorn is the U.S. distribution company that puts out all kinds of awesome British and Canadian TV series on Blu-ray and DVD. Now they have launched a kind of Hulu for people who like spinsters in floppy hats. Slings and Arrows, the official favorite comedy of Pop Culture Happy Hour, is available on this website, at least the first season is, as is a TV show called 40-something, which stars Hugh Laurie as, get this, a doctor on the verge of a nervous breakdown.
Hmm.
This is well before House, and get this, his son is played by is played by the official favorite name of PCHH, which of course would be Benedict Cumberbatch. Midsummer Murders, Dr. Zhivago with Keira Knightley, The Forsyte Saga, the first two seasons of the original Prime Suspect, all sorts of yummy, plummily accented stuff. And it's something like $2.99 a month. So I've been watching that and having a ball.
I bet you have. Yes. I knew they were doing that. They send me all their DVDs and I do very much enjoy them. And some of them get passed along to my parents who love them very, very much. AcornTV.com, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
All right, excellent. Stephen Thompson, what's making you happy this week?
I guess it is technically a violation of the Zaxxon rule to say that I'm selling my Zaxxon machine and I've already sold my broken Ms. Pac-Man machine to buy a 60-in-1 multicade.
Yeah,
well, that makes sense.
Which includes Zaxxon and Ms. Pac-Man. Oh, and then 58 other games and also some money left over. Uh-huh. So I've got your Donkey Kong. I've got maybe the greatest video game ever, Mr. Do.
Loves Mr.
King. It's got Galaga.
So verisimilitude is not important for you because the cabinet is not going to be the actual.
No, it's not a vintage cabinet, but it's heavy as hell.
This is actually something I was going to ask, is how much of the appeal is the game and how much of the appeal is the design?
It does not. Okay, what it doesn't have your artwork. It doesn't have your circa 1983 cartoon panel on the side.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, this is not just a Zaxxon rule thing that only applies to me. These are really popping up more and more.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I got this one as cheaply, I paid under $600, which is as cheap as I've really seen them around. And it's basically new. You know, but you see them turning up on Craigslist more and more, and hopefully something like Wreck-It Ralph is going to make them even more prevalent, because you really have like a full arcade at your fingertips in one machine, so you don't have, as I have, like 11 gigantic 400-pound machines.
Right.
But it is a beautiful, beautiful thing to have. Now, if you've decided that talking about Zaxxon is a violation of the Zaxxon rule, I've also been, and again, I have a little bit of a Weldonian mixed feelings about this, but the commercials for Windows 8 are basically funneled directly, not only from my brain, but from actual songs that I have recommended on NPR Music extensively in the last year, to the point where I feel like somebody owes me a cut. But right now, Windows 8 commercials feature the song The Only Place by Best Coast.
We wake up with the sun in our eyes. It's no surprise that we get so much done. But we always, yes, we always have fun. Yes, we always have fun. Why would you live anywhere else?
One that a bunch of people have tweeted me about, Kishibashi's song Bright Whites, which I said on All Songs Considered a few months ago, this should be used to advertise electronics.
New bright whites and a cage full of lights and a naked little canopy to feed my disease, my disease. I live your to smile.
And I just found out via press release today that the next one is the song Dead Oaks by Now Now. Small up-and-coming band from Minneapolis that I've talked about extensively on All Songs Considered and on Weekend All Things Considered. So either I should be going on a road trip with somebody in an ad agency, or I'm feeling especially powerful this week.
Yeah, it's and I remember, you know, the last time we had this experience was when you liked Edward Sharpe before they were on every commercial ever. Before they started popping up.
I'm right about so many things, but
it's
true. If you are this ad agency person, check out Sarah Cahoon's album Deer Creek Canyon, because I think the title track would work really nicely in like kind of a Volkswagen.
Hey, can I have a bonus related to Stephen's Zaxxon rule?
You certainly can.
One of the things that is making me happy is that I think I am about to purchase a related artifact, which is a belt from Etsy, of all things, a belt whose buckle is the lighted coin drop from
that.
A vintage game, and it works. Like, and I'm just imagining parties at which I could collect quarters.
I'm sure. I have been sent that link as well, and every time I see it, because it is an actual coin mech from an actual arcade game, it's like killing the elephant for the tusks.
Right.
It's tragic. It's a tragedy.
It's not quite like that. It's not quite like that. He knows it's not quite like that.
I know
that,
it's not quite like that.
Yeah. Okay, what is making me happy this week? One of the things that happens when TV shows that you like are in constant streaming distribution is that the ones that aren't, or the ones that you don't realize are, fall out of your memory completely. And all of a sudden, you haven't seen them in a really long time, which suddenly is a weird thing, because everything else that you love, you now own on DVD or you watch on streaming. So I have been struggling with this miserable cold, and at one point this weekend found myself staying in bed for an entire day, as I sometimes do. Yes, it was stay in bed Saturday, I'm just saying. And found myself watching Party of Five on Amazon Prime, streaming on Amazon Prime. Now, this show tends to never come up in serious conversations about how television became good. And I'm okay with that. I would never claim that this show is part of the bloodline that birthed, you know, Mad Men and The Sopranos and stuff like that. However, it is absolutely part of the bloodline that produced stuff like Parenthood and things like that. Good, interesting stories about families. Mm-hmm. And I went back and I was surprised. Now, granted, I sampled right? Things I remember that I cared about a lot. And certainly there were long stretches where I'm like, oh, I remember this. I didn't care about this at all. Clickety, clickety, past episodes, probably a whole season where I was like, I didn't care about this random girlfriend. Oh, that's right. I forgot all about the random terrible boyfriend, blah, blah, blah. But there were pieces of this that I watched that I was like, this was really good. And I was right that it was really good when I really liked it when it was on. Mm-hmm. And I was really struck by the fact that Matthew Fox, who is the lead in that show, Scott Wolf was the teen idol, but Matthew Fox is the lead in that show. And the finale of that show is actually quite good and really drives home the fact that it was always about him. I thought, I would really be interested to know whether there are other actors his age who already have two shows as A, interesting, B, different, and C, good as that show and Lost, that they have headed up.
Well, good listener challenge.
Yeah.
I will tell you one person who agrees with you about Party of Five. I once interviewed Larry David, and he went on and on and on about how obsessed he was with Party of Five, how much he loved it.
Like I said, I'm not telling you this is the show that gave you Homeland. But it was kind of part of, at that time, the whole like WB. It was on Fox, but it was part of the whole like WB youth movement response,
Dawson's Creek
and Felicity and all that stuff. It is a more serious, more thoughtful, more sort of weirdly interesting at times and nicely executed. Now, this is another one where there are a few heartbreak moments that come from the fact that they had to change the music. Some of the music stayed, but some of the music did not stay. This is the show where I originally fell in love with Sean Colvin. My little heart broke for a couple of those missing pieces of music. But other than that, I really did enjoy seeing it. And I know I have dipped into the first, I think I own the first like couple seasons on DVD. But other than that, like the late stuff, I hadn't seen the finale, I don't think, since it was on. And so it was really nice to kind of discover it and all of a sudden be like, oh, I didn't realize this was hanging around out there. So Amazon Prime, I have not checked to see whether it's also on Netflix, but it's on, it is on Amazon Prime if you happen to have that.
Yeah, I had the same reaction to The Heights, except that when they put The Heights on, they couldn't use the music of The Heights.
Thank you very much for this obligatory helpful remark, Stephen Thompson. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You can follow Trey, who is back with us after a couple of weeks away, and we are so happy to see him, at Trey Graham, Trey with an E and Graham like the cracker.
That's me.
You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow our producer, Jess Gittner, at Jess Gittner, G-I-T-N-E-R. You can follow our esteemed producer, emeritus, and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music, which you are still tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.